Up next, from the Center for Social Innovation at Stanford, Dr. Marcia McNutt speaks on crisis management during the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill. As the director of the United States Geological Survey and science advisor to the United States Secretary of the Interior, she headed the Flow Rate Technical Group, which attempted to measure the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
On Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to bring you another presentation in the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
And now, here is our presentation.
As many of you probably already know, Dr. McNutt currently holds the position of Director of the United States Geological Survey. She's also an official science advisor to the Secretary of the Interior. Dr. McNutt's office oversees the nation's water and earth mapping efforts, which, as you may imagine, provide crucial data for policymakers in various realms. Perhaps most pertinent to today's lecture, Dr. McNutt headed a group that attempted to measure the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. I presume at the end of today's lecture, we will all understand and appreciate a little better why it took so long to come up with reliable measures of the extent of the oil spill at the time. Prior to her current position, Dr. McNutt held an impressive list of academic and policy positions. I would take up valuable time if I attempted to list them all. Let me just give you a couple of highlights. She was president and CEO of the Monterey Bay Aquarium prior to her current position, and also a professor of geophysics at MIT. I think a pretty good indicator of her first-rate academic credentials is that Dr. McNutt is a member of both the American Academy of Sciences and the American and the National Academy of Sciences. In terms of education, Dr. McNutt received her bachelor's degree in physics from Colorado College. This crowd will probably appreciate the following bit of information that I gleaned from the internet, and I cannot vouch for its reliability, but apparently in going to Colorado College, she turned down an offer of admission from Stanford University at the time, which only goes to prove that there is life after, or better, without Stanford University. Be that as it may, she went on to obtain her doctorate in earth sciences from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography. In short, the Center for Social Innovation is today presenting us with a speaker of the highest caliber and somebody with intimate firsthand knowledge of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico last year. So please join me in a warm welcome for Marcia McNutt.
Well, good evening, everyone. It is indeed my pleasure to be speaking here at the Stanford School of Business. I must admit that I have given a number of talks on the science of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. But this is the first time I've spoken to a graduate school of business on this topic. So, of course, I had to go through my standard group of slides and throw out all the equations, thinking that that's probably not what you would want to hear about tonight. And I had to think again about what you might want to hear about, because certainly given the unprecedented nature of this calamity, its depth, its unconstrained nature, the 87 days that oil poured out 1 mile deep underneath the ocean, it really took a lot of research in order, and novel research in order to tame that beast. But I realized that speaking here to the Graduate School of Business audience, there were other aspects of this oil spill that you would want to hear about other than the science that went into it. Things like cultures that were involved, things like decision-making and leadership. And those are the topics that I want to speak to you today. And therefore, in titling my talk, I decided Avoiding the Slippery Slope, Leadership Lessons from Inside the Oil Spill. Because I think all parties involved in tackling this incredible environmental disaster learned a lot about leadership and about working together, and that is my message to you tonight. So here's a picture, a map from the USGS from June 3rd, and this is about as bad as it got. This, for those of you who remember back to June 3rd, this was after the cofferdam had failed spectacularly. This was after Topkill had failed disastrously. This was right before BP brought in Top Hat number 4 and the first glimmer of success when hydrocarbons started to be produced up to surface ships. And this shows when oil started to impact the shoreline of Louisiana, and every day we were getting reports of more and more shoreline being oiled. And the nation, the government, and BP were all at their lowest. There were fears that the oil was going to be entrained in the loop current. How many people had even heard of the loop current before this? And yet everyone now knew about the loop current. There were fears that the loop current was going to carry the oil spill to Florida, to the Bahamas, to Bermuda. And there were some people that were even going out on a limb and saying it was going to go to Ireland. Of course, a lot of these were pretty crazy thinking. But nevertheless, everyone was at their lowest point. But the one thing I want you to keep in mind as I speak to you tonight is that throughout this crisis, as we were addressing it, the one thing that we all were co-aligned in, whether it was the government, whether it was the public, or whether it was BP, was that everyone had the same goal in mind. We wanted to stop the oil at its source as quickly as possible. And sometimes there may have been some differences as to exactly what was the best and the fastest route to do that, but everyone had the same goal in mind. And whenever you're addressing a problem and everyone agrees on what the goal is, there's an awful lot that can be done to come to closure when everyone agrees on what the goal is. Now, I'm going to talk a lot about the sociology, about the decision making in this oil spill. And the caveats I want to say is that I'm not a sociologist. And so I'm not going to speak with the authority of someone who has approached this as an official social science experiment. I'm a geophysicist, okay? So I'm just talking personally from my own experiences as someone who spent 4 months in Houston at BP headquarters working every day on this problem. And so take it with a grain of salt. This is my experience. It's the experience of one person. So how did I get involved in this? Well, Here's a picture of me with Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar. This was very early, the end of the first week of May, when the secretary called me up out of my office one day. We had begun to realize just the enormity of this disaster. And he said, pack your bag, we're going to the Gulf. We're going to go out and see how bad this is. So I packed up my suitcase, sort of like Gilligan, for what I thought was going to be a three-hour tour, okay? So I had my little carry-on suitcase with, you know, one pair of black sandals and a couple pairs of jeans, and I packed it up for what I thought was going to be a whirlwind tour of the Gulf that was going to end up with us at BP headquarters in Houston to talk to the leadership at BP. And this is a picture of us on the docks in New Orleans. And in fact, this particular picture, we're inside the coffer dome. And I remember standing inside the coffer dome and looking at this thing. And they were explaining to us that it was a little late in being deployed because the crane that they had to load it on the ship, it had to be loaded on the center line of the ship to go out to the wellhead, because if they didn't load it on the center line of the ship would be unstable. But they had forgotten that the crane, once they extended the boom of the crane to put it on the center line of the ship, it would exceed the load limit of the crane. So everything was on hold while they found another crane. And having been the director of an oceanographic institution, the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, down the road here for 12 years before I took my current job, I thought to myself, whoa, what a rookie mistake. I can't believe that oil is gushing out at the bottom of the ocean, and we're all standing here twiddling our thumbs waiting for a crane with the capacity to put this in the middle of the ship. So by the time we got to Houston, Secretary Salazar had already decided, and talk about a leader in a time of crisis, he already had in his mind that he was going to take his senior leadership team from Interior and deploy each of us to a command center on the Gulf and leave us there until the crisis was over. So my three-hour tour turned out to a four-month stint at BP headquarters in Houston. Because he decided, having been a professor at MIT for 15 years and having directed an oceanographic institution, MBARI, with a reputation for doing the impossible with remotely operated vehicles underwater, that I was best deployed to Houston because the resolution to this crisis was going to require doing the impossible underwater with remotely operated vehicles. So while he went back to Washington to deal with the interface with other government leaders, I stayed in Houston to help put together with the Department of Energy a government team to work with BP on how we were going to stem the flow of oil and stop this wild well. Now, there were a number of differences in the government approach to dealing with this crisis and the BP's approach. And I think most of the differences that I truly saw, I would say were cultural more than anything else. And I remember when I first got to MBARI. MBARI had recently done a institute-wide personality test. One of these personality tests that I think business schools are very fond of doing, where they map out people's proclivities in terms of how they tend to interact with other people and things like that. And the way this personality test went was people would answer a number of innocuous questions, and you couldn't really tell from answering the question what was a right answer or a wrong answer, so they were perfectly benign questions. But based on how you answered this series of questions, the test would categorize you in a rainbow spectrum of being one of four colors. You were either a green, or a gold, or an orange, or a blue. And what was fascinating in terms of Imbari's as an institution was how much the color spectrum tended to correlate with people's jobs at the institution. The scientists were almost invariably dominantly green in terms of their colors. The engineers were dominantly gold. The marine operations people were dominantly orange. And our outreach people were dominantly blue. And the difference between these four colors were what people valued. The greens, who were the scientists, the thing that mattered most to them was getting the answer right. Nothing else mattered. If you didn't have the answer right, forget it. Who cares about the budget? Who cares about your deadline? If you don't have the answer right, I don't even want to talk to you. Now, the engineers saw it differently. The engineers were the golds, and they saw the universe as having many possible acceptable answers. And out of that universe of possible acceptable answers, you might pick that answer that fit your cost cap, that met your deadline, and that minimized risk. And no wonder the engineers had problems with the scientists who said, I don't care if it's not the right answer. Forget your deadline. Forget your risk. Forget your timeline. Forget your cost cap. It's not the right answer. And the marine operations people, who were the oranges, were the people, they were the cowboys. They said to the engineers, what, you want a design review that actually predicts how much it's going to cost? Can't we just put this together with tie wraps and duct tape and say done? You know, we want to get her done. We want to get her done. We want to bump back on the dock and have Miller time. And you know, they were the ones that would take a design system from the engineers, and if it didn't work right at sea, they would take their tie wraps and duct tape and they would make it work. And then the engineers would wonder, well, where's the documentation for the changes you made? And do you think I was surprised at all when we find out that there were changes to the BOP that hadn't been documented? And that came out in the report, and I'm sitting there, oh, you mean after Cameron delivered the BOP, you mean there were changes out on the rig that hadn't been documented? What a surprise. And then the blues. The blues were our outreach people. And the blues didn't care so much about the answer being right, and they didn't really care so much about schedules or budget, and they didn't really care so much about process, about, you know, the design reviews and the engineer's process. What they really cared about was, how did everyone feel about it? So anyway, we would get together in a group in Houston, and we would find that the BP folks tended to be the cowboy mentality. We're going to get her done, you know? Topkill was a great example. Topkill had been a procedure that had been the winning solution in the Gulf War. When Kuwait was on fire, Wildwell and other groups had gone in there, and they had taken what had predicted to be a 4-year problem, and in 10 months with top kill type procedures, they had put those wells out. It was a proven technique. Well, no one had ever done it in a mile deep of water, but we're going to get her done. We're going to get her done. We're going to hook up those manifolds. We're going to hook up those lines. We're going to pressurize it. We're going to pump that mud. We're going to get her done. So, you know, you have the get her done mentality, and then the scientists from the government team come in and they say, well, you know, we really want to know if it's the right answer. And the DOE engineers come in and they say, we want some process here. We want to make sure we've minimized risk. We want to make sure we've considered worst-case scenarios. And that was a very different kind of culture that came in. But the government felt that given the low point that we were at after Topkill, it was necessary in order to assure decision-makers back in Washington who had lost faith that BP could get her done, that indeed this well could be brought in under control. And so it's not as though the government team in coming in was trying to replace BP. BP had the technology. They had the skill set to do this. But it was that necessary assurance for decision making that the government team had to supply through those reviews and that green personality coming in saying, we want to make sure we've got it right. And you can imagine that this caused problems. Here we have a typical day where we've got, here's Secretary Chu, here we have Thad Allen, the incident commander, myself sitting here, where, you know, the green personalities are sitting there. Oh, we're not sure we should go ahead with this process. Have we thought of everything? Did we actually get it right? And Admiral Allen is trying to say, oh, well, if we call this off, how am I going to communicate it to the public that, you know, the scientists are having second thoughts? And James over here from BP saying, come on, I want to get her done. And so these cultures often had opportunities to clash, but nevertheless, working together, in the end, we did get her done. Okay, so there nevertheless were cases where there were examples of situations where where the government had to come in and do things that BP simply either was unwilling to do or unable to do. This is one example. I think you all heard many reports about deep oil, plumes of deep oil. And this is the Imbari Autonomous Underwater Vehicle, which was actually one of the first to detect the oil in the deep sea. And here's the detection with its CDON fluorometer. And this is the volume that it imaged in the deep sea. And the beauty of the Imbari AUV was it also had sampling bottles on it, so it could bring back samples to corroborate that the plume it detected at about 1,000 meters deep was indeed oil that was remaining in the subsurface. But this is an experiment that almost didn't happen. BP originally contacted Imbari and said, we think we need some assets in the deep sea. They contacted some glider operators and some AUV operators. But then when Imbari got to the Gulf, BP had second thoughts and decided, no, we don't want assets in the ocean looking around. And so they left Imbari sort of high and dry on the dock. Fortunately, NOAA picked up this mission and got it done and paid for this work to happen eventually. But and it's not as though BP was anti-science, because BP actually did put up a total of $500 million for science to be done by the academic research community. But unfortunately, that $500 million to be paid out over 10 years got caught up with the Gulf Coast governors, who decided they didn't want that money to go out unless it went out only to Gulf Coast institutions. So by the time all that negotiating happened, the final announcement of the $500 million didn't go out till September 30th, which was months after the well was capped. So too late to catch the smoke and gun in action. So it was fortunate that in this case, NOAA was able to step in and pick up this program to catch the signal as it was happening. And the National Science Foundation stepped up to the bat too with their rapid research grants and funded a number of academic programs. There were other cases as well of government funding academic researchers to get some science done quickly, but there were many worthy programs that simply couldn't be accommodated because there weren't enough ships in the area. The UNLS fleet was spread all over the globe, and it was impossible to bring all the ships into the area fast enough. So definitely there's a situation where we wish we could have done more. Okay, so I was in charge of the team for estimating the flow of the Macondo well. This was another issue that BP was not interested in doing while the well was flowing, though now they're very interested in discrediting our numbers. And I think that it's interesting because... Let me just give an example that was in the Presidential Commission report. There's a quote in the report from some of the BP engineers who said that BP pulled out all stops to contain the flow from that well and to try to kill it. They gave an example that if they wanted to get something machined in a shop, and the shop said they had a backlog and couldn't get that device into the machine shop, BP would buy the machine shop. Now, if BP had put that same effort into estimating the flow from the well, we would have known the flow from the well within the first week. But yet, BP's position on flow from the well was the government could do it if they wanted to on a not-to-interfere basis. In other words, don't get in our way if you're going to do it. Because our priority is well intervention. That's our number one job, so don't get in the way. And it's not that they impeded our effort to do it, but just don't get in the way. But yet, I would argue that knowing the flow from the well was very, very important. And it was very, very important on many fronts. First of all, dispersant was being applied at the wellhead, because if it wasn't applied at the wellhead, there were hundreds of people on the surface that were going to have to evacuate, and there would be no well intervention, because it was a safety concern because of the fumes from all of the oil coming out at the wellhead. And knowing how much dispersant needed to be applied was dependent on knowing the flow rate. Number two, the cofferdam failed because they didn't know the flow rate. They underestimated it by an order of magnitude. And so they tried to deploy the cofferdam right over the flowing well, and it iced up. If they instead had deployed it to the side, turned it to the right orientation so it would fit over the riser, and then put it over it, who knows may or may not have been a success. But anyway, it failed because they didn't know the flow rate for sure. Topkill failed because they didn't know the flow rate of the well. I think that they might not have even tried Topkill had they known the flow rate of the well. And all that time spent on the build-out of for Topkill that might better have been spent on speeding up the ultimate solution, which did shut in the well, the capping stack, could have been accelerated had they known the flow rate of the well. So there are a number of reasons why I think it would have been in everyone's, including BP's, best interests to have known the flow rate. So, for example, one of the techniques we used was video data. And we had a difficult time getting good video data, and that's what confounded the effort to get a timely result. The first two deliveries of video data that we got from BP gave us very poor estimates of the flow because BP, being, you know, oil guys, they didn't know how to take video data and send it to academic researchers all over the country without downgrading the quality of the video data. Basically, the ROVs dive down and they put a file marker at the beginning of the videotape when the ROV is launched, and they put a file marker at the end of the videotape when the ROV is recovered, and sometimes those ROVs are down in the bottom of the ocean for days. That made files that were too big to send to the researchers by any technique, like FTP or anything like that. And so when they tried to cut those files into smaller pieces, they had to resample the video, and in resampling, they reduced the resolution such that it wasn't possible to do the particle image velocimetry that the experts were trying to use to do it. And so, finally, what I had to do was get them to just ship the whole hard drive to some experts in video editing in order to get the pieces to the experts all around the country. But again, this is something that was not purposeful on BP's part, but if they had just put a little effort into understanding what needed to be done to video data, we would have had a flow rate estimate weeks sooner. Another example is with the acoustic method. This is Rich Camilli from Woods Hole. This was the method that turned out to be the very best at estimating the flow rate from the Macondo well. By using an acoustic Doppler, current profiler, and a sonar imager, they got 80,000 measurements of the velocity of the flow as it exited the well, and a perfect size for the plume, and nailed the flow rate. Absolutely nailed it. Plus, they went back down into the ocean with this sampling bottle and got a sample of the hydrocarbons to get the gas-to-oil ratio so they would know how much was oil and how much gas. These guys nailed the flow rate. They contacted BP days after the well blew and volunteered to this equipment to BP. BP said, no, thank you. And it was only weeks later that I could get them in the field with the help of the Coast Guard. And that wasn't until Memorial Day weekend when we could do it on a not-to-interfere basis. So, again, we could have had this flow rate weeks earlier. So this basically was the evolution of the entire spill from day one to day 87 when it finally was closed in. What we came up with was a cumulative release of 4.9 million barrels of oil, and that includes the 800,000 barrels that BP collected at the source through Top Hat number 4. The very best estimate The final estimate when we closed the capping stack on July 15th showed that the Department of Energy was able to get a flow rate of 53,000 barrels per day of oil, and that was the flow rate at the day that the well was closed in. And then Paul Shea, who's with us here. Paul, you want to wave to everyone? Yeah, Paul's right here. Paul from the USGS did a calculation of the depletion of the well back to day one and was able to show that back on day one, it would have been flowing at 62,000 barrels per day. So we were able to get this full model for the well. And this little hump here is when the riser was cut off around, this is around the 15th or so of June, that the flow would have increased by a modest amount. Now, if we compare that to all of the flow estimates we have, you can see the effect of the poor data that we got with the lousy video in the beginning of the incident. With the video, and this was another technique we used, which I'm not going to talk about, and then other early video data, whereas the acoustics measurement that I showed you from Woods Hole actually nailed the flow rate beautifully, and we could have had that measurement back here if BP had taken Woods Hole up on their offer. Other techniques... This was the final government estimate that was released when we got better data, taking into account the Woods Hole estimate plus some other data. And then this was some well modeling. And then this was a Lamont estimate and another Lamont estimate and another Woods Hole estimate. Okay, I also want to talk to you about the well integrity. This is my last topic, because this is the one time when those four colors, the green, the gold, the orange, and the blue, sang together like they were a rainbow in beautiful harmony. This was when... If you remember, the well integrity test was when the capping stack was put on and the well was shut in for a test to see if the well could hold pressure. This was on July 15th. And the reason we needed to do this was BP had suggested to everyone that as a result of the original explosion, there were some discs in the 16-inch liner that may have burst, and that mud flowing out of those 16 burst discs in the 16-inch liner was the reason why Topkill had failed. So we needed to test that possibility, because if that was true, then the well could never be shut in from the top, that we would have to wait for the relief wells to reach their target sometime in August before this nightmare would ever be over. But if BP was wrong, if the well had integrity, then we could shut it in from the top with the capping stack and end the oil spill in July, a full month ahead of the relief wells. So we put the capping stack on, and as I say, the four colors work together beautifully. The scientists considered all of the worst-case scenarios. And in fact, they even brought in outside people from other oil companies. Now, this was something that BP not only wouldn't have done, but maybe couldn't have done, because people from outside oil companies had BP called them up and said, "We want you to come and advise us on this situation." Their lawyers would probably have said, "Don't you touch that with a 10-foot pole." And in fact, the people from the other oil companies, from Shell, from Mobil, from Exxon, they all said, "You know, our lawyers have told us that this is probably a bad idea. But because you've called us, we're going to come help." And they did. They came and they helped, and they put some of our worst case nightmares to rest. And they told us some other things to be worried about. And we developed backup plans for those, and we developed contingency plans for our contingency plans. And so we knew everything that we had to look out for. And they were really helpful. And as I say, if BP wouldn't have called them, and if they had called them, they probably couldn't have come. And BP had the get-or-done mentality, and everything worked beautifully. They had to cut off the flange in order to put on the capping stack, and all the engineering had been done right, and all of the plans had been put together, and all the communication was done perfectly, not to oversell this to the public. Everyone had really low expectations for this, and yet it all went right. But, you know, we knew that this was going to be a tricky maneuver because depending on the pressure in the well, when we shut it in, and we had the engineering design had put lots of pressure gauges on this capping stack. Depending on the pressure, we knew we would have one of three zones. If the pressure was really low, that meant that the well was probably shot to hell, that it was leaking and that it was probably leaking into surrounding formations. And if it was leaking into surrounding formations, that it would ultimately broach to the seafloor and we'd have a worse environmental disaster than we currently had because it could release the entire 110 million barrel reservoir to the ocean and we'd have no way to stop it. If it shut in at a really high pressure, then that probably meant everything was really good, everything was tight, everything was sealed, and we were in good shape. If it was in this intermediate zone, then we were in no man's land. It could mean either that the well was leaking slowly, or it could mean that the pressure was lower because the reservoir had depleted itself after flowing for many, 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 many days, 87 days by that time. But we wouldn't know which was which. So we decided we could maybe leave it in for 24 hours without causing a broach, but not much more. So sure enough, we shut in the well, and what did it do? It came in at 6,700. Right in the no man's land. So we were faced with a dilemma, what to do. The government science advisors met, and they felt, with an overabundance of caution, the well, after 24 hours, probably should be reopened. They felt that we had the option to go back to collecting oil. We were only collecting 24,000 barrels of the total 53,000, but we could get BP to hurry up its greater containment, and that was probably safer than risking dumping the whole reservoir into the ocean. But without additional information, it wasn't worth risking leaving it closed in. Now, the problem we had in Houston was getting additional evidence to argue to leave it shut in because BP, while they had been very transparent about some information, for example, who could escape the pictures on CNN of the gusher coming out. You couldn't turn on a television without being haunted in your nightmares of that gusher of oil coming out in the ocean. But on other things, they were very reluctant to let information out of Houston. For one thing, they didn't want the pressure from this well integrity test out of Houston, citing concerns about insider trading, the dreaded insider trading. Well, fortunately, the government was very very dedicated to more transparency and more openness in the data concerning Macondo. And Steve Hickman, who's here. Steve, when you wave. Steve Hickman from the USGS, who was in Houston at the time, took out his cell phone, and he took a picture of the shut-in curve. And he sent this picture to Paul Shea, who I introduced to you before, who was here in Menlo Park, because he knew that that shut-in pressure was going to be problematic for keeping the well shut in. And Paul, being a hydrologist, had spent 30 years in the U.S. Geological Survey modeling pressures in aquifers. And Paul stayed up all night in his office in Menlo Park modeling exactly what that shut-in pressure and what the shape of that curve meant for the Macondo Reservoir. And the next morning, he sent back to Houston his model showing that with the Macondo well flowing at 53,000 barrels a day for 87 days, you could fit that curve based on depleting the well with no loss of well integrity. And based on that additional information, Secretary Chu decided to leave the well shut in. So, moral of the story is, it's not a great picture. It's not a lot of data. But sometimes, in the right hands, it's all you need. So, the bottom line here is that there were a lot of cultures at play here. There was the openness that the government needed in terms of information. There was the insistence on getting the answer right. There was the need for science. All of those were what the government pushed for that wasn't necessarily high on the BP agenda. But in the end, the BP and the government did work well together. The government science team in Houston had to assure our leaders in Washington that not only were we going to get it done, but we were going to get it right. And in the end, we ultimately did. And it was through the cooperation of all that that happened. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'd be happy to take questions. Adam, go ahead.
Thank you. Two former speakers in this same lecture series played pivotal roles in the effort. Carol Browner managing things at the White House, and Bill Riley is the co-chair of the commission. Can you talk about their roles and what you observed and the experience contributing to this solution?
Yes. In fact, you know, I was looking over the list of speakers in this series and commenting on what a thread it was in terms of connections, including a former BP chairman as well, who we won't mention. Yes, so I didn't have quite as much connection with Carol Browner, except for one very pivotal meeting at Department of Interior when those of us from Houston, Tom Hunter, head of Sandia Labs, and myself, and a couple of people from BP went up there with the proposal to put on the capping stack to shut in the well. And Carol Browner from the White House and a couple other people were at that meeting in which we made our case for why we thought it was the right thing to do. And she was extremely supportive, and I am, you know, grateful for her attention to the matter and the careful way in which she followed the issues with Macondo throughout. And then in terms of Bill Riley, The commission report, they did an amazing job on a very, very complex topic, and I spent a lot of time meeting with the various investigators involved, and I think that their report in general was very balanced, and they did a good job on sorting out some of the thorny issues, because in the end, when you look at a problem like this, you have to look at, first of all, what caused it to begin with, and then what was the response to it. And given how highly politically charged all of it was, the fact, and given what few resources they really had, given that they did not have subpoena power and things like that, I think they did a really great job, just because things like the complexity of understanding what caused it, given that so much of the evidence is still buried down at the bottom of Macondo and things like that, it was quite a tour de force.
Hi. Given that peak oil was first identified over 50 years ago by a Shell engineer, and we haven't really gotten organized to deal with that a priori, is this the tip of the iceberg of wildcatters roaming around looking for that last $200 a barrel oil in the deepest part of the ocean? Mm. Are we prepared for the peak oil pressures that will be on the markets to provide ever more quantities of oil?
Yeah. You know, that's a really good question. I think there are two issues in terms of the pressures of dealing with peak oil. One is the safety issue, the other is the environmental issue. And I think we have to worry about both of them equally, because the reason why peak oil has not been coming and hitting us as fast as was predicted is because technology keeps allowing us to go after resources that previously were viewed as unattainable, whether they are too deep or locked in formations that were viewed as inaccessible. Technology has allowed those now to be accessible, but sometimes at costs to fresh water and landscapes that are really, people need to take a look and say, are we really going to accept this, or do we need to more quickly move to alternative energies and leave these as last resorts? And so the safety is one part of it, and I'm hoping that many of the reforms that are being suggested for the safety enterprise will be adopted, because certainly there are smoking guns here, situations of what people thought were redundant safety devices, which really aren't. I mean, if there are many ways to trigger the shear rams, but they all depend on moving the same bolt, which can't move because the hydraulics don't work, you know, what good is it?
Hi there. What is your perspective on the media coverage given to this bill?
I think there were some cases where the media did us a huge favor, and other cases where the media crossed the line in terms of sort of making the news rather than just reporting the news. Let me give you what I think was one of the media's shining moments. And that is, there was a situation where people in the academic community started becoming concerned that about something that they called BP buying up academic scientists, and offering to support their research in exchange for scientists signing documents that would say that they wouldn't publish their results for a certain amount of time, and that that they would be basically sort of on contract to BP. And the media got hold of this and basically also found that there were some universities that were refusing to be part of this, and their scientists were refusing to be part of that. And once that made the news, then basically there became a groundswell of universities that absolutely refused to be part of that, and BP decided, you know, this isn't in our best interest. We should basically honor what is the academic practice of if we can't get good scientists to do good research and publish their work and have it in peer-reviewed journals, it's obviously not going to be credible for us to show that research either. And so it was all a very good result in the end. And that was, I think, one of the media's shining moments. But I think the Presidential Commission report shows some examples where they also felt that the media was trying to make the story rather than just report the story. Mark, yeah, you have the...
Marcia, as you know, the Presidential Commission has called for a complete overhaul of the U.S. regulatory system. Is it your sense that that call is going to be answered by the Department of Interior and such large-scale changes in how we regulate deepwater drilling are going to take place?
Well, I think the Department of the Interior has already announced what changes it's going to make. Whether the commission views that as what it had in mind and is enough. Remember, after Three Mile Island, there was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that was set up completely independent of Department of Energy. And certainly... this is not as sweeping as that. I've certainly heard viewpoints that say that maybe was not entirely the best approach too. So, I've heard all sides on that approach to it. So, we'll see whether this is the last word or not, but I know that certainly Department of Interior has taken major steps to remove what were clearly conflicting missions, because before, how can you tell an agency, we want you to be an agency that maximizes return on investment to the American public from developing offshore energy, and by the way, we also want you to ensure safety and compliance with all regulations. I mean, those are absolutely conflicting. So that's now separate.
While the well was flowing a fire hose of oil, there was also a fire hose of suggestions coming in from scientists and engineers and wildcatters and everybody.
Yes.
How does an aspiring senior manager develop the skill to pick out the ones of those suggestions to go champion and move forward with the one that'll be successful?
Okay. Yeah, it was difficult to be on the other end of that fire hose. Basically, there were a whole bunch that were in the category of blow up the well to kingdom come. That was one big category. Those I basically put in one big email file and sent those to my friends in the Department of Energy, because they are in charge of nuclear weapons. And they're the people that are experts at blowing things up. And fortunately, they were very good. In fact, the most wonderful person in that group was one of their science advisors, Dick Garwin, whom many of you may know. Dick Garwin worked, actually, he was a student of Teller's, and he worked on the original H-bomb. And he had Enrico Fermi's original notes that he went back to and showed us all that blowing the well up would not work. So we could put that one to bed.
Wow.
That was very good. There was a whole nother class of suggestions which made me realize how many people were either heart surgeons or had had heart surgery that were basically catheterization of the well. Okay. You know, blowing up balloons in wells that are flowing at 53,000 barrels a day was going to be a challenge. But then there were all sorts of others that were everything from sketches on a cocktail napkin, and I can't tell you how many cocktail napkins I really did get, to engineered systems from the Mediterranean that actually had worked in similar situations. The ones that were already engineered systems had a chance of actually being deployed in this situation. Those I sent to the Coast Guard. The ones that were cocktail napkins, no way we're going to get this anywhere. So.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems.
To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Stephen Eng. Our website editor was Marguerite Rigoglioso. The series producer is Bernadette Clavier.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nie on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.